This is Al Williams, president of the San Francisco African American Historical and Cultural Society. We're here today with some of our guests at the culmination of a program celebrating the commemorating the 150th anniversary of the 1850 exodus of African Americans from San Francisco to British Columbia. We have with us today Ms. Linda Richardson, Linda, who is a commissioner with the San Francisco Human Rights Commission and is also a candidate for the 13th Assembly District Democratic County Central Committee, the Reverend Amos Brown, minister at Third Baptist Church, Glenn Nance, who's the head of the African American Studies Department at City College, Guy Washington, who is with the National Park Service, a ranger with the National Park Service and heads up the Underground Railroad Program, and Christy Black, who's the program manager at the African American Art and Culture Complex, which has hosted this event today. We just wanted to get your reactions to the program today. We know that some of you are pushed for time, so we want to get some thoughts on this, on the importance of the commemoration. And I want to start off with Reverend Brown. Reverend Brown, during the program, you talked about the importance of connecting the dots and how the three of the historic churches in San Francisco, the importance they've had, not only in San Francisco history, but in a broader history. Would you elaborate on that just a little bit for us?
Very much so. These three communions, in my estimation, were inspired by the writings of Harriet Beecher Stowe, whose book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, was published in 1852. Harriet Beecher Stowe's father also was president of Lane Seminary in Cincinnati, Ohio. In fact, the story goes that she was inspired to write this book at communion service one Sunday when she heard the preacher talking about the Christ figure and how Christ was a person for others. And just the day before, she had heard about the slave over in Kentucky who was so magnanimous, who was so caring and concerned about others, but she saw in him a figure, a symbol, a parallel of Jesus. And many people have mischaracterized Uncle Tom. Uncle Tom was a person of nobility. If someone was picking cotton and they didn't have their quota for the day, he would take cotton out of his sack and put it in their sack so that they wouldn't be beaten. And the one instance in which he was really beaten to death practically was when he refused to tell Simon Legree where those two runaway female slaves went to. They beat him because he wouldn't snitch. And yet there's been this Vaughnville mischaracterization of Uncle Tom as if he was a person, a despicable person, of no character, no strength. And the only reason why he didn't leave that plantation is because he knew that if he left, he would never see that family again. He was a family man. He was concerned about keeping that family together in spite of the hardship of slavery. So when she wrote this book and the cruelties of slavery were reflected, and the nobility of Uncle Tom, that book inspired blacks to be self-determining, to stand up for their rights, and as Abraham Lincoln said to Harriet Beecher Stowe when he met her, "So you're the little woman who got this war going." That book created the agitation. So that it was easy. It was a welcome exercise here in California for those persons who migrated from Virginia and other parts of the South here to move out of these white churches and organize their own churches, which became Bethel African Methodist Episcopal, First AME Zion, and Third Baptist.
Amazing. I mean, that same strength of character that you talk about when those people came here also seemed to manifest itself in the actions on the part of the people who migrated from here to Victoria. Linda, you have any thoughts or reactions to the program today in that regard?
Absolutely, Mr. Williams. every time that I come to the African American Historical and Cultural Society, I am very inspired. And I just want to say, and for our community, that this is not only a historic occasion. The fact that the preservation of the history and the legacy of the African American in the diaspora, I think we know that the story has not even been told. And we are at the cusp of the 21st century, and we are now going back to try to revisit and preserve the history of the African American people, the migration from Africa, connecting our peoples together all over. Here we are, that we are learning that San Francisco played a significant role in the history of that. And you, Mr. Al Williams, your work as the president and the leader of the African American Historical, this is it right here. Your persistence in going out, your collaboration with the faith community, with other organizations, with other cultural organizations to bring about the preservation of the history of the African Americans are so significant that I need to underscore that. And it is a pleasure for me to be sitting here because the history of the books that have been written that we not even looked at, and the fact that we are going to be now engaging the Unified School District for them to really look at integrating in their curriculum. The history of the African people is unprecedented in San Francisco. And I just hope that what we're about to start here, it is going to energize not just San Francisco, but it's going to connect the people in Oakland and challenge them to what they are doing. And as Reverend Brown says before, there are people in Atlanta, we need to connect the dots. And this is a historic occasion. I am so glad that I am part of this.
Thank you, Linda. And Glenn, as an educator, you're at City College and head of African American Studies. How do you see this information and its relevance to students at City College and not only African Americans, but all the various ethnic groups that are represented there and understanding the importance of their histories as well?
Well, one thing that we have to take in consideration in our own time, and that is the demographics of San Francisco. And that is, there's an exodus of sorts going on right now, in which a lot of people, a lot of black people, are leaving the city of San Francisco and leaving the Bay Area for various reasons. So we kind of have a repeat of what was going on at that time. And some of the causes are very similar, you know, and that is, it's because of lack of opportunity of people of both places. But I think that if we stand back and get a little perspective on what happened, especially from the way that San Francisco, that California came into the Union, and that is through the raid on the Alamo, which led to the war that President Polk declared on Mexico, supposedly for the purpose of the Alamo, but in effect really to take over the western part of the United States, make the United States a continental of power at that time. Mm-hmm. So the United States kind of came into, California kind of became a territory and later on a state of the United States, you know, just as an acquisition land. It kind of reminds me in a way of the reason that we went to war with Iraq, you know, just to kind of go in and what President Bush did, you know, just to take over territory and oil or whatever, and that's kind of the same way that that happened. So later on, when actually the first, we kind of think of there not being too many Southerners out west, but the first governor of California, Governor Barnett, was from the South. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of Southern sentiment and interest in the state of California. And actually, even though in the Compromise of 1850, they chose to not have slavery in California per se, there were still a lot of those attitudes that were, you know, that coincided with Southern attitudes at that time. One reason that they didn't want slavery was because a lot of the Southerners who left and came out to California were poor, and they didn't want to compete with slavery as they did, you know, back south. So in the Daily Alta newspaper, you know, one of the banners said that they saw the California and San Francisco as being the white man's empire in the West. And that was kind of, and that's why we have Dennis Kearney, you know, attempting to drive the Chinese out, you know, labor leader, you know, to get rid of the Chinese and others, and to get, and it's, there's an irony because California was probably the most multiracial, multicultural state in the United States, but when they think about it in terms of, you know, of whites being, you know, white supremacy in this state, you know, they had something on their hands. So what we see happening with the migration, you know, that began to Victoria, it was just an outgrowth of the same, you know, the various legislation and pressure that was put on people, non-whites in California, who were deprived of their rights. You mentioned the Mary Ellen Pleasant, you know, and, you know, she was a civil rights activist, you know, in San Francisco, and she led to the integration, actually, of the public transportation system. You know, she did many other things, even though she was derided by the people who lived here. You know, they call her Mammy Pleasant, you know. So she wasn't given respect for a lot of the things that she was doing. You know, she was suspect. You know, people thought that she was, worked voodoo or something like that. But that was the kind of opinion that people held of this very high esteemed woman, you know. So it doesn't, what we see is kind of an atmosphere, you know, in which it was very difficult, you know, for not just blacks, and I think that we can't limit it, you know, to black presence only, but many non-whites who were seen to be expendable or who were in the way, at least, of progress, you know, in San Francisco and in California. And that's what they were all up against. Now, later on, we have like the Garvey movement, you know, and a lot of people know that as a Back to Africa movement in the 1920s. But during that time, we don't actually see black people actually returning to Africa. But to me, what's significant about this is that a lot of the factors that were at work affected the people to the extent, you know, people like Mifflin Gibbs, you know, who was a businessman, you know, he wasn't just, you know, somebody out there, ne'er-do-well, whatever, but people like that decided that the only alternative they had, say, especially after the Dred Scott decision in 1857, you know, that the only alternative they had was to leave and to go somewhere else, you know. They were looking at their options, and I think that we're, like I said, you know, there's that relationship between past and present, you know, like where people get into a situation, you know, where it's very difficult and you have to make hard decisions. But they stepped up and made those decisions, and in my estimation, it was a very good decision that they made. You know, it's too bad that they had to leave at that time. But I think that the idea of, you know, we can't just kind of, if the conditions are such, sometimes we can't accept them and just stay in one place. It's necessary to find a way to go. So going back to what your question is, I think that given the problems, you know, that many of our younger blacks are having, you know, today and everything, that they're going to have to kind of look at the reality of what they live in and not resort to, you know, the those kinds of, you know, just petty crimes or the drugs or whatever, but to kind of get a perspective on what they really, the decisions, the tough decisions that they really have to make to improve themselves or to make decisions about their own living in our society today.
You referenced a couple of times in your comments something about the economic situation, and Christy Black and I were talking before the program started joking, seriously, but using a joking reference to it being all about the Benjamins and about being the economics and the economy of it. Christy, from the African American Art and Culture Complex Center focus and being program manager here, you work with young people, all kind of different people who come in, all kind of programming. How do you see the importance of this information and getting this information out to the clientele of people who come to the center and make use of the center from your perspective?
Well, I think it's more than just being significant. It's just imperative that this information is shared. This is history that is covered for a reason. It's because it inspires, it motivates, it changes people. And I know that I've been changed. And just working on this committee, I felt like I had a lot of background information. And just in working in this short period of time over the past few weeks, so much has been uncovered about the history of California that I didn't know. So much has been uncovered about the Underground Railroad that I didn't know, and the significance of all of these people that were so determined to be free. And I see our young people right now in chains. And I see so many people in chains in their mind because they just can't see the power that they have. And that's one of the significant things about being here in the center is watching artists take their own power and transform it and use that power to change people's lives. And I think it's something that is just so powerful, and it's so empowering to young people, to people my age and 32, to people that are older, just to be inspired to do something to motivate ourselves and to motivate are the ones that come after us.
Right, yeah.
And so I just think it's just imperative that this information is shared, and it's my hope that this dialogue is just now going to just break the ice.
Right, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that we can begin to go deeper and deeper, and that this is the beginning of this memorialization of all of this information, and just an awakening for all of us to do something to uncover this history that has been deliberately covered.
Yeah.
To keep us in chains.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting that one of the, when we look back over the history of the Historical Society, one of its original objectives was to create a cultural center in San Francisco. And we never quite got there, but the fact that you guys here at the African American Art and Culture Complex do represent that and house a number of different cultural elements, including the society, and the program you offer certainly fulfills a critically important need that we have. You know, telling this whole story, one metaphor for telling the story, all history is around travel and how travel moves us from one place to another, from one point in the story. Guy Washington, National Park Service, you're head of the National Underground Railroad Program in this area. Would you talk just a little bit about your perspective and how this fits, this